Let's return for the last time to Helen, and let me complete that for you. Once Helen incarnated, of course, you know that she became a phenomenal figure. She became an incredible figure. And that she and Annie met at age 7, when she was 7 years old, right on time. And through the years, of course, she learned to read Braille in multiple languages, and she became a writer, and of course, a tremendous healer, a planetary healer. She healed. She had a contract as a healer, and that's the shape it took. And she chose again and again and again to take the courageous response to a challenge that could in many ways have scared many people to the extent that they would have remained in their home hiding for safety, and not just scare her because of the vulnerability of not being able to feel your way in the outside world. But there was also a degree of shame and humiliation and all of that kind of embarrassment that she had to confront. This woman was brave. This soul was incredible. And compassion provided so much for her. It provided friends, Thomas Edison, Alexander Graham Bell. They loved her. Isn't that interesting that two people whose whole life was communication grabbed onto this woman? An interesting series of contracts. Compassion, again and again and again. Ways were found, methods were done, and Helen reached the world. This is how you look at a contract. As an agreement you make that always has elements of necessity to it. It always has elements of choice, and it always has the presence of compassion. Now, I wanted to take you up yet another notch because this is a very important introduction at this point. We're going to be talking in this program a great deal about archetypes. Archetypes and mythology. Mythology plays a tremendous role in your life, whether or not you realize it. Mythology, fairy tales, folklore. When I do readings on people, I can tell, for example, that they have an alignment to a certain fairy tale, that they're actually living aspects of that fairy tale. What an outrageous thing to say. Yes, it is outrageous. And you know what? If I take that fairy tale and sit down with them and I'll say, come here, Snow White, look at this. And you can see that they are truly living aspects. And there are 7 dwarfs in that person's life. And they may not be literal dwarfs, but there will be 7 helpers. Oh, yes, there will. And the outrageous reason the heavens, here is again the guardian of compassion, has set up folklore and mythology and such incredible stories, mythologies, is because they serve as a type of magnetic spiritual path. All right? And what that means is they get you to where you're going because you don't know where you're going. And these mythologies, these contracts, what it does is it kind of locks in a certain way that you roll through your life. And the more conscious you become of yourself and of the power of your choices, the more consciously you can write the endings to these fairy tales. Are you with me on this? Okay. So upgrade we go. And when I was looking into a larger perspective on contracts, I discovered that the Romans and the Greeks had a god named Mithras, a very famous god, the Greeks. And Mithras was called the god of contracts. And they believed, and it was understood, that before you incarnated, you had a conversation with Mithras, and Mithras handed you a task. And more or less the understanding was, don't come back here unless that's done, or until that's done. And it was completely understood that your birth was no accident, that it was a divine command, a divine purpose, that it was completely divinely ordered, and that you had to live a life accepting every day as essential to the whole of your contract, that it just wasn't one task to reduce the purpose and significance of your life to one action that might happen sometime when you're 41 years old is preposterous. The whole of your life is a contract. And this perception of incarnating and making agreements is older, or is as old and as far back as we go, which means somehow there is truth to it. We do make agreements. We are on assignments here, and we aren't with each other for casual reasons. Now I want to share with you something that's absolutely delicious, and that's that there is a myth about a place called the River of Forgetfulness. And you're meant to take a drink from this river before you incarnate. Now, this river is mythologically known. It's recognized. The same cultures, the Greeks, that had Mithras, had this river. They knew somehow that once you got your assignment, that it wasn't permitted that you incarnate fully aware of your assignment, because then the test didn't count. Nothing counted. Then why bother going down? It would be too easy. You would not be able to face your own polarities. It would be too simple. I did two readings in the whole of my career in which two people told me, and these people didn't know each other, so I want to emphasize that. These two people told me identical stories about how they ran, jumped over this river because they just didn't want to do it. They didn't want to drink from the river. And they flew over it and descended into physical life without having followed orders. And as a result, here's one story. One man said he never became consciously prepared for the limitations and parameters of human life. Rather, his psyche has remained huge. Now, he said that he had full memory of being in his mother's womb and of waiting to be born, and how horrible it was waiting 9 months to get out. He said that he remembered the birth canal. He said that he remembered that he was a very alive, alert, old being in a new body. Well, of course, we're all old being. What kind of news is that? The only thing that's changing is we're finally recognizing that children are conscious. It's not that they're suddenly old beings, it's that our light bulbs have gone on. But he said that he was limited by the limitations of a little body. He couldn't make it talk at 6 months, even though he could hear at the level of an adult. So he described these years of being miserably frustrated and incredibly unhappy. But the worst part for him was that he knew that by not going into this deep state of human unconsciousness, of allowing his unconscious to put the veil on, he had prevented himself from having choice in his life. He'd taken it away. And choice is perhaps the most profound power we have in life. In fact, it is, from my point of view, the core power. Even greater than the power of love, because to love is a choice. Now, your contracts in life are all of them, each one of them. They are meant to increase that sense of awareness as to who you are, as to how powerful you are, as to the creative force you are, as to how powerful each one of your thoughts is, how incredible life is, and how much of value every task you have to do in life is. So, as we explore contracts further in this program, I want you to hold in your mind the perception that absolutely everything you've ever done and everything you're doing is of value. I want you to hold in your mind the fact that it's very difficult for you to hold in your mind yourself. The majority of you is rarely in your body. Most of you, all the time, is anywhere but in the moment. You're either in your past, or you're worrying about something that's other than the now. You're worrying about the future. You're anywhere but in the moment. And because you're anywhere and everywhere but in the moment, you devalue the value of the moment. And that's why you can't see the contract being played out in the moment or the significance of it. That's why you eclipse the value of what's going on in this minute in your life. As we continue, the assignment that I want you to hold, what I want you to do, is stay as much in present time as you listen to this program as you can. And when you feel yourself slipping, note that. Stop the program and start again. Note when you start slipping, because that's going to show you how little attention you pay to your own life. And this is why you have contracts. Because left to your own psyche, who knows where you'd be.
This concludes Session 1 of Sacred Contracts with Carolyn Mace. Our program continues with Session 2. Sounds True presents Sacred Contracts, Session 2, Sacred Contracts of the Masters, with Carolyn Mace.
What exactly is a contract, and how best should you understand it? Two images come to mind as the best way to put a visualization in your head so that you can follow with me as I describe what could have been your descent into physical life. The first image, I want to take you way, way back up into the heavens, and you haven't yet come into your physical body. But you're armed with information. You've spoken to the beings of necessity, of choice, of compassion. You have a sense of direction. You're about to incarnate on an experience in which you're going to integrate creation. You're going to explore how it is you have the power to create, form, influence the flow of matter, and how within that experience you can enhance the growth of other people, of other souls. You're about to learn with every single life you live that that's what life is about. It's about discovering that there is no difference between you and another being, and yet you are fully yourself. That in fact, the journey of life is all about giving up life for the journey of the spirit. You're about to learn that. And each one of you is in your backpack of life. You have a detailed, personal, intimate map as to how you're going to accomplish that. So now, your spirit holds that map and you begin your descent. And then you take that map out and you take your spirit out and it begins to sparkle and fall apart, shredding itself, shattering itself into 1,000 pieces. Now each one of those pieces, think of it as a sparkling unit of light. It's you. It's a sparkling piece of you, a part of your spirit, that's going on an individual journey, and you're going to go and find that piece. And your job is to retrieve that piece from wherever it is. But in order to get it back, you have to have an interaction with someone or with something, or you have to be part of an event. You have to co-create some type of experience. You have to earn your spirit back. And that's the way I want you to think about it. And so now your spirit travels and it finds its way to a very selective group of individuals. Not everybody's going to get a unit of your spirit. Now imagine that unit jumps into their backpack and it's waiting for you. It's waiting to find you, and it begins to beam just like a wave and vibrate because you can feel yourself. You can feel your energy all over the place. You can sense where you are and you can sense where you're not. You can walk into a room and feel, this is very familiar to me. Or you can walk into a place and feel, I don't know where I am. I'm very disoriented here. You can meet somebody and think, this person is like an old friend to me. Or you can meet somebody and think, I can't be anywhere near this person. Point being, you have a response. And sometimes the response is completely illogical. I don't even know this person, but I feel as though I've known them forever. Completely illogical responses, but not if you held in your mind that maybe this person is someone you agreed to meet before you arrived in this physical body. Now let me give you another image, and that other image is that I want you to imagine that your spirit is like, or your soul if you prefer, is like a server in the internet. And it's a very conscious, kind of a mechanical device. Because in a sense, your spirit is a mechanical device in that it is subject to the laws of the universe. Thought equals form. Whether it's your spirit or mine, that law applies. That's its mechanical aspect. Cause and effect. For every thought you generate, you will generate an effect. That's a mechanical reality. Whether it's your spirit or mine, that law is real. So there is a mechanical or very ordered aspect to your spirit. So here you are as an internet server, and you're connected to a number of individual computers. Those individual computers are you. Each one is one of your spiritual fragments or spiritual units. In fact, this is a very effective image because what's really true, and follow this because it's an extraordinary thought, but it's a real thought, is that every one of these units is filtering back information to the server all the time. And this is real. Every one of your units of yourself is actively working somewhere on your behalf. Even though you have yet to meet somebody or have yet to experience something that may be 5 years down the road for you, believe it or not, in some way, even now today, you're preparing for that. You're preparing to meet someone or be a part of something that has not yet happened. So all of this energy is happening simultaneously, believe it or not, because it's absolutely the way it is. And think about this. Everything you learn today, right now, you transfer that learning to all 1,000 fragments of yourself, wherever you are. So all of you is learning simultaneously and impacting and influencing all of you wherever you are. Now, that's an extraordinary thought. It's a positively extraordinary thought, but then life and creation is an extraordinary adventure. And let's put it this way, that to begin to think in larger, more energetic, more extraordinary terms about who you are and why you're here actually helps you to realize that is the reason. That to reduce the thought that you're here to do just a job on this planet is to eclipse all of the contributions you make as a being because you reduced yourself to a doing machine. And while that is a very Western point of view, to measure the value of your life according to what you do, that is also a very painful illusion. And we pay for that because we struggle a great deal with that illusion. You're also born to become. And what you're born to become is a whole being. As a way of introducing that perception, I thought it would be of great interest to take you into the contracts of four people that you're going to recognize, whose lives we consider to be more divinely oriented than ours. And that's why I've chosen them, because what you're going to see is that they, like all of you, were born not knowing their contract. They were not born knowing how powerful they would be if they surrendered their personal will to a higher source of wisdom. And we'll talk about that as we move on. So I use them because they illustrate the divine pursuit. These beings are Jesus, Buddha, Muhammad, and Abraham. And these four spiritual masters share these following characteristics, and I chose them because they completely illustrate the generic way of a contract. And let me remind you that I'm now talking about the umbrella contract under which all of your individual experiences of life are gathered. So, let's begin with Abraham. I'm going to reduce their lives to a very bite-sized proportion. And I need to say that because, let's face it, I mean, I could keep you here forever telling you about the extraordinariness of their life journeys. So, with Abraham, remember that here's this man who's wandering around in the desert and he hears a voice, and the voice says, "Hey, Abraham." Well, it was Abram, actually, in the beginning, and he said, "I want you to start a whole country." And his response is, "Who is talking to me?" Now, do you understand what this is saying? It means that he had no idea, first of all, who Yahweh was. They hadn't met before. So he hears this voice, and it says, "Start this country for me, will you?" Now, his whole response is, "Lord, beat it. Go away. I don't even know who you are." Think about this. Think about a command. He was not born knowing. So as somebody would say to him, "What are you going to do with your lifetime?" And he didn't say, "I have a command to start a nation." He grew into this. And he had to be tested. Like, do you have what it takes to follow that inner power? Now hold that in your mind. Because again and again, I am going to refer to two aspects that I introduced earlier. Choice and surrender. You have a choice. You have a choice whether or not you're going to follow me. Your inner voice, that inner direction, will give you guidance. But again and again, you have a choice as to whether or not you're going to follow that. So Abram was directed. And heaven had to find out, will you listen to the guidance I give you? Will you surrender? Will you listen unconditionally? This was a test. All of these teachers had that same test. Abram's test, you know what it was, to take his son to the top of the mountain and to listen as the angel said, slay your son, Yahweh wants that. So he pulled out a knife and he was about to kill his son to follow this command, only to find out the angel said, you don't have to do that. All we wanted to find out was, could you listen? Could you surrender your will? Here's the key. Please listen to this carefully, without needing to know why. Now, this is another characteristic that your contracts in life will lead you again and again into these mysteries that say, I don't know why I'm doing this. I don't know why I'm with you. I don't know why I have to be here. But I do know that my choice is either to fight this or to surrender. And the surrendering is what I want to drop into your soul and into your mind again and again. A contract is an experience, a relationship, a challenge, a mystery that will always hold a question for you. Can you surrender to the outcome that you can't see coming? And I will tell you that every one of your contracts in life will challenge you in this way. For example, let me take you down just a tiny sidebar so you can relate a little bit more to this. Think of a relationship that you love deeply or that threatens you the most. Because those are the two that you're going to want to control the most. You're going to want to control them because these are the two kinds of relationships that can pull the rug out from under you. So they're the ones that you're going to want to control the most. Somehow or other, it'll bring out the most manipulative side of you or the darkest side of you. You have a contract. These are contracts so that you can find out, discover how frightened you are, how insecure you are, how unbelievably unable you are to say to God, I'm taking my hands off this relationship. I don't know why this person's in my life. Except to say, whatever it is I'm supposed to learn with this person, experience, maybe this one will be with me forever, maybe not. But I'm going to say, I will enjoy, absorb, learn from this as much as I can. And when the work is done, which may be tomorrow or it may be to the end of my life, I'm going to have to trust that the length of it and the endurance of it, the wealth of it, the challenge of it is in your hands. I don't know many people who can say that prayer, even though that's the truth. So returning now to Abraham, he was able to say that, I surrender, I surrender. Now let's jump into the life of Buddha. Here's Buddha when he was Siddhartha. And his father wanted to protect him from what the outside world looked like. His father wanted to what? Make all his choices for him. Protect him. Keep him in this beautiful home so that he would never see, this is very important, the shadow side of life. He would never see the shadow. He would never have to think that maybe, maybe, maybe the gods, the heavens, had two faces. A face we didn't understand. How could I be so wealthy? How could they be so poor? How could I have such a full belly of food? How can that person be starving? Is there such a thing as a contract that one would starve? Does that make any sense? Well, does it make any sense that a person would have a contract to have so much? What is the difference from heaven's point of view? Obviously, nothing. This is important for you to hold in your mind. Contracts are neutral. There's no such thing as a wonderful contract and a horrible contract. There is just the nature of a contract, which is that it is a journey of learning, and it has challenges to it. It has faces to it. It has events to it. It has a cluster of experiences to it, all of which unfold according to how you direct them. You can take a contract like this one individual that a friend of mine met on a bus in Chicago. This man lost his leg in some kind of accident. He said, you know what? It could have been worse. I could have lost both legs. And you know what I think? People look at me, and it's hard for them to look at me, and I notice that. So what I do is I always say to them, it's really hard for you to look at me, and I think you got to get over it because a lot of people look like me. And he said, I think that's my job. I think it's part of my job is to help people get over looking at people like me. Now, you could think, look at that. Do you realize what a gift that is? And for him, he says, I think that maybe that's my role. I look at people, I look at them looking at me, and I feel like there's another person I got to talk to. Now, that's a man who lives contracts. Do you understand? He lives it. As he pulls together every single person, he spots someone looking at him. He feels what I'm going to teach you about animation. He feels their response. You can feel someone responding to you. You get that electrical charge. That's animation. And when he feels that, he knows I've got to go make that person look at me and make that person get over the discomfort of looking at me and thinking that if I look at you anymore, you who doesn't have a leg or an arm, I'm not looking at you because I have that fear that that's going to happen to me. And I got to get over that fear. And so he says, I make people look at that fear, and that's how I heal them. So who's the cripple? The person with the leg or without the leg? Is this not divinely paradoxical? That's the language of the divine. So let's go back to Buddha. Buddha is about to be pursued by heaven. Buddha says, I got to get out of this place. It's too perfect. There's got to be another side of life. This doesn't make any sense. It's too perfect. There's no polarity. So he sneaks out and he finds the world. And then he discovers, oh my God, there's people starving on this side. There's people hungry and lost, and they don't look anything like the perfect world I come from. Who's in charge of this world? Who's ordering this? So what does he do? He goes on a search, and heaven pursues him. Now the pursuit begins. What's a pursuit feel like? The same thing you're going through. It feels like, what am I supposed to do with my life? Where should I go? What is life? What's the meaning of life? Exactly how should I fulfill my life? How do I know when I'm fulfilled? He asks all these questions. Do you think you're the only one asking these questions? You're under contract to ask those questions. Why? Because they stir your electricity inside your soul. They wake you up. These are the questions that wake you up. These are the questions that make you explode and want to go sample, feel, seek, touch, taste life. You've got to ask these questions. You begin in confusion. And I got news for you. There's a real good chance that you're going to live a lot of your life in confusion. Why? Because confusion moves you. It moves you. It makes you ask the next question in life. What if you got what you asked for? I want you to imagine something. What if you said, well, what am I supposed to do here, and where do I belong, and just tell me everything I want to know? I want you to imagine something. You go to bed one night and something wakes you up and says, wake up, I got the answers to your questions. And you sit up in bed and said, what? Look, this is what you're supposed to do, and this is who you're supposed to become. This is where you're supposed to go. Let's get this over with. Number one, you think you were born just to do a job like, oh, I don't know, start a healing center and just be perfectly and totally happy. And you say, yeah, that's what I want. That's the information I want. Uh-huh, that's what I want. I want my job. I want my retirement. I want my pension program. Just make sure I'm always happy. Will you do that for me? Uh-huh, right. So then you say, and by the way, while you're at it, who's my perfect soulmate, lover, perfect happiness, perfect person, so I will always be perfectly perfect? So then you get that one. Oh, yeah. So then your angel says, okay, so your perfect person is this one. So then you get to say, so now I know what I'm supposed to do and what I'm supposed to be. So then your angel says, yeah, that's it. So now you get to say, well, what am I supposed to do with the rest of my life? And your angel's going to say, oh, for God's sake, I'm out of here. What more do you want? The journey is to fill your own belly with the unknown, Don't you know? You're here to fill the unknown with yourself. Do you know that most of the questions you ask in life are never going to have a reasonable answer? Because they're not supposed to. They're supposed to lead you to wonder and to wander. This is the journey, to fill in, to make choices when you don't know the answer. And then after you make a choice, suddenly, you know a contract is complete because your belly feels full of power. That's when you know you've made a right choice. So let me continue. Let's go back to Buddha just a minute, because we can't leave him under the tree, because that's where you know Buddha ends up. He moves, he walks, he's searching, he starves, he does everything to try and make life logical, to try and make sense out of life. And you know what happens? It doesn't get him anywhere, and he finally decides, that's it, I'm done. I'm sitting here until God talks to me. That's it, I'm not moving. Because life isn't logical, and I demand logic. So there he is. Who knows how long he hung out there? There's myth, there's legend, there's folklore. Some say he hung out there for years. Who knows? Does it matter? Not at all. What matters is he finally wakes up enlightened. Now, I want you to think about that word, with light, full of light. What does that word mean? It means that all of the fragments I talked to you about, all of the parts of your 1,000 spiritual units of the self, he had managed to collect while sitting under that tree. How did he do that? How did he do that? Let's just play what if, because I'm not enlightened. So at this point, I want you to understand, I am standing a great big huge distance away from Buddha. I'm about to offer you a speculation. But in my heart, something tells me that maybe some part of this is accurate. What Buddha did was surrender. Buddha decided, I don't know the mind of God. So I'm going to stop asking God to tell me the mind of God because I'm not sure I have a right to know that. Two, I'm going to live according to this perception that where I am is where I'm supposed to be, and that there is value in everything I do, in every place I am. And it's up to me as to whether or not I'm going to see that value. Number three, I'm responsible for the manner in which I conduct my psyche, my soul, my consciousness. I'm responsible for that. I create, I influence, I am. And it's reflected in the way I use my spirit. Number four, there are commitments I need to keep on this planet. I have to live in that assumption. I have to live in the assumption that if someone reaches out to me for help, that's not random. That's scripted. That if someone falls in front of me on the ground, that's not random. I have to pick them up. And if someone doesn't fall in front of me, I have to look, perhaps bless them, but they're not for me to pick up except with a loving blessing because they fell in front of somebody else. And that's that person's job. My job with them is to bless them and keep going. My job is to attend to the tasks that seem to come into my life and the ones I'm sent into. Sometime, the gods will send me on a task that says, we want you to help run this business. It's important because you've got skills. You've got a genius at strategy. You've got the kind of strength that inspires people. Take up this task and run. Other people are going to be given a task. You are so creative. Please, please, please use that creative ability of yours and inspire people with creating quilts. So, do anything but share that creative ability. Other people, you have got a heart so warm, we have got to send you on missions to embrace other people, to love them a little bit more where others have not loved them enough. There are so many missions that you're sent on. These are missions. These are tasks that only you can do. It's up to you to choose whether or not you're going to value them. Buddha would teach there's illusions in the world. This is where part of your contracts send you. They send you into your illusions. Your contracts send you into illusions. What do I mean by that? I like to call these the Buddha contracts. These are the ones that send you into situations in which you're going to find that what you thought was power has no power. What you thought was a big deal turns out not to be a big deal. Here's a contract. I want you to think about someone whose approval you're desperate to have, but whose approval you never get. I want you to think about that. Surely there must have been one person in your life or one person in your life. And if there isn't, I can tell you there will be one person in your life that you meet whose approval you are desperate to have and you won't get. Not at all. And that's a contract. Why? Because it's going to engage you in wanting to pull back a unit of power in yourself to empower yourself so that you don't need that person's energy to feel good about yourself. Because that's what empowerment is about. And you're going to know it when one day you say, you know what? I feel so strong today that I actually can look at you and say, whether or not you like me, need me, approve of me, want me, no longer matters. And you have no idea how good that feels. And that's when you know a unit of your spirit, a fragment, has come right back into you. And you feel that fullness, and you feel stronger and more vibrant than you felt before. That's how you know you have a contract, and that's what it feels like to have it complete. But let's go back. Buddha was pursued until Buddha decided to surrender the need to ask questions and to trust that there was order in life and that everything that was put in front of him, he was to see as having divine power built into it, that it wasn't for him to judge the value of something, but rather to assume it had value and to act from that posture. Let's go to another one. Let's move into the contract of Jesus. This is one of my favorite contracts. All right. Now, Jesus arrives at the temple. Let's just get to the temple. Let's bypass everything else. I don't know what he did between birth and 13. Who knows? But let's get to the temple. And in the temple, he has an epiphany, an awakening. He's 13 years old. He's going to get bar mitzvah anointed. He's at the temple. And he tells his parents, "Don't you know now it's time for me to get about my father's business?" Now, this is very interesting. Because where does that come from? Now, watch this. Watch this. It's so extraordinary. I'm going to jump around his life because I have to weave pieces together to make sense of the contractual motion. And oftentimes, you're going to do the same thing. Because a contract holds together pieces of your life, and not in a linear way, but in a, isn't it fascinating? Tomorrow feeds into yesterday, and then there's today, and you'll see if I can get you to float way above your life and look over it. You're going to see like a hologram how all of the pieces connect in this beautiful pattern simultaneously. So I want you to descend right back now. We're back. We're in Jerusalem. We're in Bethlehem. We are 2,000 years ago. We are back in time. And we're looking at this young boy who's just awakened. And he knows in his heart, in his gut, that he has to be about, how fascinating a word, his father's business. Well, that's intriguing. What father? He had a father. He means some grander source, some hugely cosmic divine source that he recognizes he's descended from. Let's have a question here. Does he know the full extent to what he's doing? Well, there's some clues along the way that he does know some things, but he doesn't know others. Now, that's the important thing. Why? Because here again, we have the chemistry of choice and surrender. The chemistry of the unknown, choice and surrender. So he goes about his life, and he vanishes, as we all know, from age 13 to 30. We suspect now maybe he was in a mystery school. Probably he was in a mystery school. Let me say, I believe he was being educated in mystery schools. But you can think what you want. Nonetheless, at age 30, he returns. And he emerges into the scene with a baptism. Intriguing. In the baptism, what does he do? He accepts the power of choice. Ooh, this is fascinating. He goes through a ritual, and he accepts the power of choice, and he's anointed. What does this mean? Think of this. Just flow with me as I talk about this, and I want you to flow. I want what I'm saying to you to flow into your system. I don't want you just to hear me. I want you to feel what I'm saying. I want you to just let this flow in you. Picture this. I want you to picture yourself standing in water. Now, remember water's emotion. He is standing in water. You are standing in your emotion. You are knee-deep in it. And something forceful comes into you and just basks right over you. It just moves right over your head and down over your body and into your being. And somehow a force moves in and you feel yourself, feel your spirit. I want you to just feel the animation of your spirit. And a question is put to you, the deepest question that can be asked, and it's, will you consciously use this force now? Will you accept responsibility? Will you accept the responsibility for the conscious use of your spirit now? Can you do it? Will you do it? And he says yes, and he wakes up. He wakes up. He's been anointed. Think, this is what being conscious is about. And now he sets about the task of consciously using that spirit. What does that mean? Look at how he used it. He consciously used his spirit as a vessel to heal, to teach, to treat every human being with such dignity. And he also laid a template that is the way to treat others in this lifetime. Did he know that he was supposed to do that? I'm going to have to say, I don't know. I'm going to have to say that maybe, in that experience of that light coming through him, that's often illustrated as a dove above his head, that dove and the Bodhi tree of Buddha were similar imageries, that there was a moment of a great awakening in which he realized, you know what? The highest contract is to serve those that my Father in heaven, his name for it, puts in front of me. And I will vessel, I'll channel whatever energy needs to come through me in order to accomplish a task. And I do not need to know what that task is. I don't need to know why. All I need to do is to repeat this. I've chosen to serve. I don't know what the outcome is. I have no idea why it's me. I don't even need to know why. All I need to do is trust that if I'm with you and I feel that certain energy, what I need to do is act according to higher principles and not be attached. Here's your clue. Not be attached to the outcome. Never be attached to the outcome. Now we're mixing an interesting chemistry here. We're mixing the chemistry of Buddha and the chemistry of Christ. Act in present time. Act with love. Act with brotherhood. And Buddha, don't be attached to the outcome. I am telling you how to interact with your contracts. And I'll get to the grounded level, but not till I have you absolutely templated so you know what to do once I drop you on the earth. Because I'm not going to leave you on your own. until I carve you with this precious information, which is the contracts of the masters who have gone before us. Now then, here's a part of the contract of Jesus that is perhaps one of the most extraordinary features. And that's, there he is, having taught. And he wanders about and he heals and he teaches and he teaches and he heals. And think about one unbelievable healing experience. Think. There is a scene in the scripture, and it's one of my favorite, where he's teaching and the apostles are all around him. And there's a crowd, and the crowd's screaming, heal me, this, that, touch me, heal me, give me. And you know what? Let me tell you something. The more conscious you become in life, and you can expect this, as if we're all going to be that conscious. Oh, please. Let's just hope we get conscious enough not to run each other over when we get to a stoplight. Okay, that's about as best as we can hope for. Let's none of us flatter ourselves. But suffice to say that there comes a time when, just when you think you've become so enlightened, you're going to be tested. Great big huge test. You're going to be surrounded by people and smashed and squashed just to see really if you've got such a forgiving heart or if you really have developed such a generous spirit. So here's the scene. Jesus is in this crowd, and here he's not even looking behind him. And this woman wants to be healed. And she says, just let me touch the hem of his garb. And all she does is extend her two fingers and touch it, just a tiny touch. What does he say? Who touched me? Peter says, are you nuts? There's 1,000 people around here. What are you talking about? He says, no. I felt the power go through me. Ah, did you hear what I just told you? Yeah. I felt the animation go through me. I felt it. I vesseled it. I don't know who I touched. I don't know why, but some force went through me, bypassed my own will. I didn't choose to let that energy go through me. A greater choice than my own was made. I was used. It flowed through me. I didn't look at her and decide whether or not she was worthy. It just shot through me. That experience captures so much of what I want to teach you. That a contract with someone bypasses your reason many, many times. And it is an exchange of energy. And it's an exchange of your spirit. That if you trust in the context, and I'll describe this in a very earthy, grounded way, but I want the principle to get into your head, that your interactions with people in life and where heaven might send you or where you've agreed to go, there's a real good chance that it's not going to make sense to your conscious mind and that you might never be told why. Your position is again and again simply to say, I agree. I agree. I agreed to this somehow before I got here. I don't know why I'm here. I don't know why I'm part of a situation where my house was burned down. I don't know. I haven't got a clue. I don't know why I was in a situation in which I won the lottery and I'm suddenly worth $400 million. I have no idea why I agreed to that. I haven't got a clue. All I know is it's an event that happened. And I need to work with that. How do I work with that? Well, I'll take it one choice at a time. And I have to trust that I made agreements with people who'll help me deal with this, whether it's to rebuild my house or to share my wealth or to invest my wealth, to grow my wealth. All that I need is going to be provided because I provided for that before I incarnated. I will not choose to lose my spirit, to continue to shatter myself into 1,000 pieces by worrying about tomorrow. That's not the wise way. Go find in any scripture, any spiritual master who says, leave me alone for a while, I've got to worry about tomorrow. I want you to find that teaching. You won't. I'll buy it from you if you find that teaching. You will never find a teaching where a spiritual master says, I need a retreat so I can worry about tomorrow with a lot of precision. It's not going to happen. What they teach you is, don't give it up. You're under contract. Everything is taken care of. All your needs will be met. Will you please stop? Jesus says, will you please look at the lilies of the field? What is wrong with you? Stop it. Stop losing your spirit. Don't invest your energy in such trivial, negative pursuits. But here's my very favorite thing to close on the life of Jesus so we can move on. At the end of his life, you know that he went to the Garden of Gethsemane as we enter into the crucifixion drama of his life. Now, the most important part, perhaps, or shall we say, one of the most important parts, significant features, is when he's in the Garden of Gethsemane, gets on his knees and he says a prayer. And he says, why do you want me to do this? I don't want to do this. And then he says, but if it's your will, I'll do it. Do you understand how significant that is? Let's dissect that for a moment. Did he say, I'm not doing this until you tell me why? No, he didn't say that. And number two, he just said, I don't know what I'm doing. I haven't got a clue why I'm doing this. It's going to be ugly and brutal and savage. I haven't got a clue. Do you understand he didn't even know his own contract? A part of it, perhaps the greatest fulfillment of it. He still wasn't revealed. Here's the wholeness of why you had to live the fullness of your life. Still, that wasn't told to him. And yet, let's turn around real fast, whoosh, and go back. He had a contract with the 12 men that he chose as his apostles, and indeed the 13th, Mary Magdalene. This wasn't an accident. He chose these people very specifically. They incarnated to be his team. He had contracts with them. They all formed bricks underneath this roof of his house, which was his sacred contract. Each one was a contract, an individual one that served the whole. Each fragment you collect is an individual contract. Peter, Matthew, James, John, Andrew, all of them, Mary Magdalene, his mother, Joseph, all of these people, Simon, Judas, every one of them, a contract. All right, now, let's jump from Jesus. Let's go, whoosh, over to Muhammad. Now, here's an interesting one. I love this. Muhammad, of course, was left to his own devices until he started to hear voices. Allah was calling him. And he thought, oh, I'm getting out of here. And he started to hide in caves. He'd go anywhere to not hear these angels, to not hear the voice, to not hear a calling, to not hear his calling. He was not born knowing that he was going to be a great prophet, that he was going to bring a text through, to bring teachings through, beautiful, beautiful teachings, a beautiful scripture. He didn't know that. He had no idea. And he fled. He fled, but the angels pursued him. Until finally he gave in, gave up, and gave way. He did all three things. And with that, he was sent his helpers, and his life began to come together. Now, Muhammad was tormented in the early years of his teachings. He wasn't embraced. He was tormented, and he had to fight, and he had to become strong. Now, there's an interesting thing here. There's an interesting fact in this part about Muhammad's life. Like there is, perhaps, in the lives of all of us, when you deal with the illusion that if you're on course in your life, it should be easy. No. No. When you're on course with your life, sometimes you go through the most difficult things in the world. This is one I so often hear people say to me, I must be doing something wrong. I feel so lost. I feel so empty. Even that is a part of your life's journey, don't you know? We just don't know how to value emptiness. We've decided there's no value in it, and we've decided there's no value in being lost.